Today we have a very special blackboard talk. First of all, no blackboard. That's really special. Neil Turok is one of the first and most famous KITP postdocs. He came here at the beginning of the Institute years ago. By the way, that's Nicola, whom you were going to meet. Right there, you could just. In the early 80s, just as the ITP was getting going, and he's one of the examples we quote when trying to convince the NSF that this is a great place for postdocs, is an example of somebody who came here as an expert on Katz-Moody algebras and has turned into one of the leading cosmologists of our time. So he's an example of somebody who has benefited from the broadening experience of the KITP postdoctoral program. Many of us know Neil for his work in cosmology, and in fact, right after this talk, he's going to explain how the universe might avoid singularities in its past, in its eternal past. But today, Neil is going to describe another one of his endeavors and accomplishments, which I regard equal, if not surpassing, his accomplishments in physics. And that's his attempt to help his native Africa, rise to, if not a level of leadership, at least participation in modern science and development and technology. A few years ago, Neil created, almost single-handedly, but with the help of many of our colleagues as well, a new institute called AIMS, which he's going to describe in this lecture, located in South Africa. And since we'll hear lots about it, I won't say too much about it, except that from what I've already seen at the beginning and of this and what I know about AIMS, it is a truly remarkable and novel, very creative way of addressing some of the most important problems in the world, especially those in Africa. So I'm sure many of us will be interested in this academically, and some of you might also be encouraged to help Neil in this effort in whatever way you might find it possible to do so. I wanted to tell you also that Neil is here partly because he just attended a remarkable conference held in California, right outside of Silicon Valley, called the TED Conference. Whether any of you have heard of this TED thing, it's somewhat of a different community than ours, but this is a very high-level group of technologists, designers, entertainers, and very successful entrepreneurs in California who are interested in many, many things and hold a conference once a year, among which at this conference they recognize three people and give them the TED Prize. And this year, Neil was one of the three people who was awarded the TED Prize. They've given the TED Prize to a remarkable group of people, and you know, I think Neil is certainly the first theoretical physicist, if not the first physicist, to win this prize. Last year, in his place, they chose Bill Clinton. The year before, in his place, they chose Bono. So, Bono, Clinton, Turok. It is an incredible honor, actually, because it is given to somebody who, by his actions or her actions, has changed the world already and has a dream to change the world in the future. And the prize is partly to encourage and help them achieve their dreams. I'm not sure whether Neil might tell you a bit more about Ted, but I think we should all congratulate him on this wonderful prize. And with that,
okay.
Neil Chorok.
Okay. Is this working?
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't need that. Yes, it's been a pretty amazing few days. And I've been talking nonstop for 4 days to many people. And so if I'm slightly disoriented, please forgive me. As David said, this TED Prize, it's $100,000, but that's not the real prize. The prize is you get to make a wish. And you make the wish in a room where there is Paul Allen, Sergey Brin, Larry Page, founder of Amazon, all these characters. And my wish is extremely ambitious, as you might expect. and I'll maybe get to my wish later. But the response was just unbelievable. And so this morning, last couple of days, I've just been deluged with offers. And for me, this is quite an amazing experience because, you know, we sit in Britain or Africa, we look at the US, and there is so much to criticize. And it's very easy to fall into anti-Americanism. But you come to Silicon Valley, and what you see is the good thing about America, which is this open-heartedness, enthusiasm. You know, you can set the highest goal. We're going to the moon, right? And the response is fantastic. So I've set a very high goal, which I'll tell you about later. And the response has been absolutely unbelievable. And the consequence is that I think the next 5-10 years is going to be very, very exciting. Now, it all began for me when I was a child, born in South Africa. My parents were sent to jail for being members of the African National Congress, which was opposing apartheid, a racist regime in South Africa. So when they were released, we left and we moved to East Africa. And so I was a child in Tanzania and Kenya, and we had all kinds of problems. We had no money. my dad didn't have a passport. But we had the most amazing childhood because, you know, these were new countries. Kenya and Tanzania were just got independence, full of hope for the future. The people are incredible. Kilimanjaro, Serengeti, Olduvai Gorge, where humanity came from. Oh, hi. I'm just slowly seeing friends in the audience. and so we had this marvelous childhood, and I had a brilliant maths teacher who I still stay in touch with. She's now 80 years old. And then we went to England. And it was so kind of gray and depressing in comparison. But of course the education was better. And then when I was 17, I took a year out before university, and I went to Lesotho, a small country surrounded by South Africa, where 80% of the, very poor country, where 80% of the men work in the mines over the border. And I was a teacher, maths and science teacher, for 9 months in a village school, a Roman Catholic mission school. And I had a fantastic experience. I mean, even though these people were subjected to brutal conditions in the mines, and and apartheid was everywhere, white superiority was everywhere, they welcomed me. I mean, I was this kind of irritating young white guy. I'm sure, and the warm-heartedness was unbelievable. But more important than that, the kids were very bright. I'll just tell you one story. Oh, hi, Tony. this may go on. The kids were really very bright. So one example, I used to try to take the kids outside to connect maths and physics with the real world, because they were taught rote learning. You know, you copied what the teacher wrote into your book, regurgitated it in the exams, that's all. All those bad habits we have in the West, the developed world, are there in Africa, but times 100. Okay, so education is truly Victorian and it's a complete disconnect from reality. So I took the kids outside and I said, okay, estimate the height of the building. And they had rulers, and so I expected them to put the ruler there and, you know, measure up with their fingers and say, oh, it's about, you know, 10 meters or something like that. So there's a little boy there who was very small for his age, undernourished. He was the child of one of the poorest families in the village. And he was scribbling with chalk on the pavement. And so I said to him, oh, come on, what are you doing? I want you to estimate the height of the building. He said, oh, yeah, I've done it. He measured the height of one brick, and then he counted the number of bricks, and now he's multiplying. See, I hadn't thought of that. And there were many experiences like this. I mean, the same kid I set as an exam problem. I set an exam for the class, and I wanted to check, what's their reasoning power? So, you know, in biology, you construct these classification trees, just binary trees to classify objects. They'd never done this in class. I gave them 10 objects. I said, right, construct a binary tree to classify these objects. And this guy just did it like that. No sweat. And many experiences like this. Anyway, really stuck in my heart that there were kids in this place with very bright minds who had no prospects. I mean, the best they could hope for was an office job in the mines instead of going underground. That was the very, very best they could ever hope for. So I went to Cambridge and was a postdoc in Santa Barbara. I went to Imperial. Where did I go? Cambridge, then Imperial. Then I was a postdoc at Santa Barbara. And, you know, worked on cosmology and finally got my professorship in Princeton. And then I moved to Cambridge, where I was with David. And I had, you know, job security. And during this time, the change in South Africa happened. And so democracy came about. And my parents both were elected to parliament in South Africa. So in 2001, I took a research leave and went there and was writing the first paper on the ekpyrotic universe in Cape Town. But while I was there, I was talking to people about, you know, what the needs were of this new country, South Africa. And it's so important South Africa survives and succeeds. So many things stacked against it, but it's vital for the future of the continent that it succeeds. To my surprise, they said, we really need maths. There is a terrible shortage of mathematically trained people in government, industry, universities, high schools, just don't have high-level math skills. So what are they doing? They're buying off-the-shelf software. They can't write their own software. In business, in government, they can't. Statistics are not properly kept. They're not doing good modeling. And computers, I mean, how do you make good use of computers without math? So it's a terrible problem. So I had this idea, let's set up an institute for the whole of Africa. We'll recruit the top maths, physics, engineering graduates, bring them all together, recruit the best lecturers in the world, and I mean the best ones, because people are interested in Africa and they're willing to come to Africa for 3 weeks to live with these students and teach them. And, you know, let's see what happens. It'll just be an experiment. So that's what AIMS is. And there's a lot of other background, political background. It's not easy to set up a collaboration like this. There's 6 universities involved, Oxford, Cambridge, Paris, 3 universities in Cape Town. There's a lot of sort of consensus building you have to do to set up a project like this. That's the website. So I just want to sort of summarize the experience of the last few years in the following way. Africa needs science, that's obvious. How are you going to solve all these problems of disease and poverty and so on without science? It needs science. But my perspective somewhat changed over the last few years, which is that I think science needs Africa. In other words, we need Africans involved in science. I think we'll all be surprised when they do get involved in science. They're starting to come through, 5 same students at Cambridge this October, and I think we're all going to be surprised. Now let me just summarize Africa's situation for you. There's a lovely project called World Mapper, based in Sheffield. And what they do is they take the map of the world and they scale the area of a country in proportion to various quantities. It's a very just graphic way of showing statistics. So that's the usual area map, equal area. Africa's a big continent, there's 53 countries. And let's look at the GDP of Africa in 1960. 1960, that's when they got independence. Okay, so pretty small. 1990, 2002, 2015. That's a projection, right? So you can see China booming. Africa's been eaten out this side by America, and now it's eaten out that side by China. So that's the position with Africa. By the way, over this period of 45 years, $1 trillion in aid has gone to Africa. $1 trillion. Okay, and to first approximation, there is no lasting consequence of that aid. The traditional aid model has failed very badly. And mostly what it's done is prop up various groups of people within the continent who've benefited from it and outside interests. But, you know, this is where Africa's going. So it's time for a different approach. We've got to try different things. Okay, so here's the population of Africa. It's not out of proportion with its size. But Africa leads the world in deaths from often preventable causes. This is malnutrition, simple infections, birth complications. Okay. Africa's overwhelmed the rest of the world. Deaths from HIV/AIDS. And deaths from war. Okay, right now, 45,000 people are dying per month in the Congo because of a war over many raw materials, one of which is coltan, used to make tantalum, which is in everybody's cell phone, laptop, the best substance for making capacitors. And there was a boom in the commodity price 5 years ago, went through the roof, it multiplied by a factor of 30, and that ended up with the formation of armies in the Congo, and they're still, the armies are there, but the price has fallen, now they're just a horrendous situation in the Congo. What about Africa's way of solving these problems? Here are the number of physicians in Africa. Here is the number of people in higher education. And here are the number of scientific research papers published each year from Africa. Okay, so they are just not involved in the modern knowledge economy. So what do you do about this? Well, there were quite a few opportunities to take advantage of. So we started formulating this institute in 2001. The internet is a huge plus, and free software. All over Africa, you will find internet cafes, and you'll find bright young Africans paying ridiculous sums of money to connect to the internet. They want to connect with the real world. They want to be successful. They want to be global citizens. And so that's a big plus. And we use the internet to do all our recruitment and communication. We've built up a network using the internet. New South Africa is an incredible opportunity. Forward-looking country. They want to host the Square Kilometer Array, the biggest radio telescope in the world. They put $100 million of their money into prototype. The country is very keen on science, very forward-looking, wants to connect with the rest of Africa. NEPAD is the New Partnership for Africa's Development. It's an organ of the African Union. And these are new organizations, but they're formulating policy across the continent, trying to get cooperation, peace, trade, etc., etc., democracy. Students in Africa are incredibly highly motivated. There's 700 universities. Each one graduates maybe 5,000-10,000 students per year. Large numbers of people coming out of universities. And they are very highly motivated and totally starved of opportunity. Thank you. I should have brought my remote. It's in my office. Africa is a very beautiful continent. Fantastic locations. Costs are low. Cost of educating a student in Africa at Ames, at this institute where we set up, is one-fifth of what it is of bringing a student to the US or Europe. So economically, it doesn't make sense to bring Africans here and teach them, and they're also very unlikely to go back. If you train them in Africa, you're building institutions there, you bring outsiders to Africa, you're bringing one lecturer to Africa instead of 50 students in the West, it just makes obvious sense. It's global goodwill. We are massively oversubscribed with offers to teach at Ames. Literally, we can get the best lecturer in the world in any subject. And that's a wonderful thing about the global academic community. If you work in Africa in science, you do have competitive advantages in certain fields. Obvious ones like modeling of disease, tropical diseases, HIV/AIDS, internet problems in Africa, communication, finance problems in Africa. If you specialize in those fields, you can become a leading international figure. And, you know, we have to push those fields. So we bought an old hotel. That's the hotel. We bought this building, 80-room hotel. We bought it for $100,000. It was in a rundown area. David came to see it and was amazed. The area around it was basically a lot of other buildings, not as nice as this, but run down. It's now one of the premier tourist sites in Cape Town. All the buildings around it have been bought. Value of the building has gone up by a factor of 15. and we have the best building in the area. So students live in. Top two floors are accommodation. The next floor down is a computer lab here, a library here, a lecture theater, common room, dining room on the ground floor, and it's just a beautiful old 1920s Art Deco building. 24-hour learning environment. Okay, and the lecturers live in. It's extremely intense. A big focus is on teaching excellence. 50. Roughly 50. Now, right now, they're 53. I'll show you the students in a moment. So the idea is to recruit the best lecturers in the world, very cost effective. Generally, they don't want to be paid. We pay an allowance of something like $1,000 for 3 weeks, plus airfare and food and board. And we're just overwhelmed with offers to teach. Very cost effective. We encourage interactive teaching. We build up a culture where it is not acceptable to stand at the blackboard and blah, blah, blah for an hour. Okay? You talk for 10 minutes, you stop, you break the students into groups, you set them a puzzle or a problem, they solve the problem and come back to you. It's constant feedback within the class. And once you have this culture, lectures are sort of forced into that way of teaching. And it's very, very exciting. And lecturers come away saying, their style of teaching is transformed by teaching in this environment. I mean, it's definitely happened with me. I cannot teach in the old way after teaching at Ames. We emphasize problem solving. It's not about grades and exams. We have very minimal grading scheme. You can get a distinction, but that's about it. Tell the students this is not about grades. It's about discovering your own interests and your potential and maximizing them, and we arrange everything to do that for every student. And so we deliberately de-emphasize grades in exams. Lots of group work, projects, tutorials, middle of the night. I mean, last time I was there, we were discussing Einstein's equations at 1 a.m., and the discussion just keeps going and going, and the group of students expands. Everyone has questions. So the students call it the house of no sleep. It's really a 24-hour learning environment. It has a Pan-African student body, which is very exciting. Currently 53 students from 20 different countries, and that is an incredible source of excitement and stimulation. And they're Muslims, Christians, Francophone, Anglophone, every kind of racial type you could imagine. Africa is the world's most diverse continent, and it's a huge stimulant to the students and the lecturers. The course I'll just review quickly. The beauty of setting something up from scratch is you can actually think about what you're doing and design it. Yeah. They apply on the web. It's a very complicated application form. And they have to fill out all sorts of boxes and criteria. They send in their transcripts. Basically, we're looking for people with first-class degrees. And we have local contacts in about 20 countries, and when we have a dilemma, we ask for their advice. So we take input from the contacts we have. But we've built up it's quite difficult to do, but we've built up now a set of people we really trust, their opinions, and the selection, I would say, is not straightforward, but we're oversubscribed by 6 applicants for every place right now. Okay, so the course, we designed a novel course, which I would claim is the best course in the world for giving a brush up of your skills, plus a broad overview of all of science and how you might use maths in science. And that's how we've designed the course. So the first part of it is those skills which are needed in every science. And in fact, across all of science, there's a single skill set which 95% of scientists are using. How to formulate a problem mathematically, how to put it on a computer, how to do data analysis, modeling, so all those skills. And yet we don't teach it that way normally in a university. Normally it's biology or physics or chemistry or math. But there is a common skill set, and also scientific writing. So that's the first part of the course. Then we have review courses, which change every year. There are 15 courses, and the students choose 10. And those cover any sort of hot topic, interesting, where you could conceivably jump in and get into research fairly quickly. But those review courses are not a comprehensive training by any means. They're just a taster. They do involve math, they involve problems and all that, but it's just a taster. The point of the review courses is to let the students decide, what am I going to do with my life? There's so many scientists jump into a field without thinking. And 10 years later, they discover it's actually not that exciting a field. And especially in Africa, okay, much worse. So we've designed this course so the students spend 4 months actually thinking about what they really want to do. That's what the review courses do. They do lots of computing. Every course has to have a computer project. They end the course writing an essay, and we have very intense supervision of those essays. Last year we offered 100 topics for the students, and they are supervised by local academics in the 3 local universities. So the essays... 9 months, yeah. 10 months, 10 months. Then they go off and do masters.
In its first year, the African Institute for Mathematical Sciences has recruited postgraduate students from 16 countries across the continent. Many had been planning to leave the continent in order to continue their studies. But Ames is trying to turn Africa's brain drain into a brain gain. Internationally acclaimed lecturers and students live together in a converted hotel just minutes from the beach. That location is considered one of the top reasons why busy academics are so happy to come here.
Well, you know all about that. Okay. So these are last year's graduates. There were 48 graduates of AIMS last year, and they all go off to master's and PhD programs. Of the 48, 45 are now on master's and PhDs, which I have never heard of any institute around the world with that type of success rate, if you like. Yes. Yes. Finish a first degree, come to AIMS for 9 months for a brush up and review, and then they go off to these universities to do masters and PhDs. And one's working in a computer company, some are doing part three maths in Cambridge, so that's what happened to the students last year. Last year, significant numbers started going to Europe. Before that, they were essentially all continued to South African universities, but now we have saturated the capacity in South Africa. So a lot of the students go to Europe, and we have a plan for getting to bring them back, which I will explain. So this is our progress. We measure our progress by coloring a country yellow if we receive an application, orange when a student is admitted, and green when they graduate. This was the situation after the first graduation in 2000. Yeah, this is after the first graduation in 2004. Okay, so at this point, students had graduated from, I think it was 13 countries. And the yellow ones were ones where people applied, but we hadn't admitted them. This is 2005, during the year. And 2006, 2007, 2008. So our goal was to turn the continent green, and we're well on the way to doing that. And now we need a new measure, which I'll also explain for what we do next. Only in English. Turns out the Francophone students are learning English on the web, through the web. No, there's lots of Francophone countries, Madagascar, Congo, Cameroon, plenty of Francophone countries. The reason we've not succeeded over here is these countries, students go straight to France. And of course, Somalia is just a war zone. Angola has also had war for a long time, doesn't really have functioning universities. Libya, people don't like to go outside for a variety of historical reasons and so on. But the spread has been phenomenal. The word has just spread all over the continent. And now, you see, each of these graduates, they're connected to AIMS. We have an alumni of 160, plus the 53 there currently. We have information about the academic scene in Africa, which no one else has, because the best source of information is the students. We see how good they are, they tell us which are the best institutions, they're our diplomats, they're our ambassadors, and these are the people going to change Africa. Okay, sorry, so we had some of the students filmed before they came to AIMS. I'm just going to show you one because of time, but we had several of them filmed. So this is Tendai, who was filmed in Bindura, a rural town in Zimbabwe.
My name is Tendai Mukoba. I have a Bachelor of Science with Education degree. I will be attending AIMS. My understanding of the course is that it covers quite a lot, you know, from physics to medicine, in particular epidemiology, and also mathematical modeling.
Okay, now I'm going to show you a film of where Tendai is now. That was 2003, and here she is now.
My name is Tendai Mugogwa, and I was a student at AIMS in 2003 and 2004. After leaving AIMS, I went on to do a master's in applied mathematics at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. After that, I came to the Netherlands, where I'm now doing a PhD in theoretical immunology.
Penda is working very independently, and she communicates well with the immunologist at the hospital. So all in all, I have a very good PhD student from South Africa, so I'm happy she's here.
And I want to show you another one. This is Shehu. He's from northern Nigeria. and so here he is at high school. Here he is entering university. This is the largest university in sub-Saharan Africa. Ahmadu Bello University has 45,000 students. So he came to Ames again in 2003, came to Cambridge, did part three maths, and here he is today.
Now from there we'll be able to hopefully make better predictions, and then we compare with MSUGRA and also make some predictions for LSC.
That is nice.
Yeah. That was, I have to admit, that was slightly staged. But he's finishing his PhD this year, working on LHC physics and phenomenology, so I hope some of you here are interested in that. But if you are, you're going to see this guy running around conferences. He's done very well. He works with Fernando Quevedo. Fernando's his supervisor. Some quick stories. This guy on the left, Jules, came out of the Eastern Congo, that area I showed you, devastated by war, left as a refugee, went to Tanzania, Malawi, Zambia, Botswana, imprisoned, expelled, traveled, journeyed with no money and no papers for 9 months, ended up in a refugee camp in Namibia, took the entrance exam to the university. This was in 97. Took the entrance exam to Namibia University, got in somehow, got an honors degree, first class in maths, taught in Angola for a year, private college, and then came to Ames. He's just finished his master's in computer science, and he's got a German fellowship to do his PhD. He's working on the African internet and how to optimize protocols and so on. Angelina from Tanzania, Northwest Tanzania, area devastated by AIDS. She's just won Third World Academy PhD fellowship, which she'll be using to do her PhD, both in Tanzania and Switzerland, on modeling AIDS, spread of AIDS in populations. Eve is from Cameroon, peasant family, 9 kids. His parents scrimped and saved to put him through university. He came to Ames, he feels this huge obligation to do well. He didn't do a master's, he went straight to his PhD, and he's just finished his thesis. Last December, he won first prize for the best student talk at the South African Mathematical Society. So now he's actually tutoring at Ames before he goes to do a postdoc. His PhD is on lattice theory in pure mathematics. These are the current students, 53 of them, from 20 countries. 20 of them are women, and there are some really amazing people among them. This is how Ames has operated. I mean, when we opened, we had this derelict building with a pile of rubble in the entrance hall and no lecture theater, and that was in 2003. And we had no idea about the interest that would develop. So this is Nature. 2005, this is front page editorial of Nature about Ames, this is Physics World, this is the Cambridge Alumni Magazine, Nature Materials in November last year, and in Physics Today, there's an article coming out this month about Ames. There's a lot of interest in this project. The TED Prize was awarded, as David said, and so last month we had a party at Ames. In Africa, we have lots of parties. And we have very, very good parties. and the spirit and enthusiasm is simply overwhelming amongst this group of students. I want to point out 3 of them to you. This is Ezra. She's from Darfur. And she's a physicist. We had a woman last year from Darfur as well, who's now doing propagation of radiation through insect bodies, because that is relevant to sterilizing the males to try to stop pests without using pesticides. So she's a physicist. Here she is as well. This woman is Lydia. She's from Central African Republic. She's the first ever woman graduate in mathematics in the Central African Republic. Quite hard to get to the Central African Republic. There are no airlines, there are no direct flights. anyway, so she's there, and this is Mercy from Kenya. And she's an applied mathematician, and of course she's very worried about Kenya because of the crisis, but also very encouraged by the U.S. Situation. We hope to see a Kenyan running the USA. Then there might be some rationality. But so we decided, with the spread of AIMS, we've set ourselves a new target, which is to create. AIMS has run for 4.5 years. We've fine-tuned the model. It works extremely well. We think we have a great product, and now is the time to replicate and roll it out all over Africa. So for the last 18 months, we've been running around Africa. This is our site visit team, and basically, we've been investigating a lot of sites and seeing where else could we do this. South Africa is certainly the easiest place to do it, but there are lots of other possible places. And these are the five other sites we have selected as the leading candidates. Ghana, Nigeria, Sudan, the whole story about that, I'll tell you if you're interested in, Uganda, and Madagascar. Yeah. At TED, a group of biotechnologists met with me, and they're very keen on basically making partner institutes in biotechnology, which would be linked with these AIM centers. We would want to do it in entrepreneurship. We want to add in a wealth creation element to this program, so that the bright students, many of the bright students, go in to form startup companies and so on. So definitely. The reason you see, maths is ideal to do it first, because it's cheap, objective. Everyone agrees 2 + 2 = 4. You don't have any debates about policy or, in maths. Maths is clear cut, so it's the best subject. There are plenty of good maths graduates in Africa, and if you select people who've got first class in maths, you're getting very good students. So maths was sort of the easiest, but I think it can be used as the basis for the other. You don't need labs. If you do biology, you need labs. So I think it's an example. The core principles behind AIMS, which underlie everything we do, is that whatever we do, it should be relevant, meaning not ivory tower. This has got to be actually relevant to the society in a broad sense, opening the minds, etc. Relevant, it's got to be innovative. Most universities are not very innovative. This has to be innovative. So you jump ahead and jump into fields that are exciting and useful. We use free software. Don't want to buy stuff off the shelf. We want people to develop the skills to make their own software. Has to be cost effective. And no compromise on quality. And why? Because we want Africa to be rich instead of poor. In May, we'll be opening a research center at AIMS. So far it's just been education, postgraduate education. But now we want to add a research element to it, where the research done will be innovative and interdisciplinary, etc., etc. So we bought this building, it's being renovated. There's one next door, same size. And together that'll be the AIMS Research Center. And it'll house about 40 researchers, including graduate students. These are the fields we've chosen initially to focus on: biomass, financial math, astrophysics and cosmology. The first two are obvious. The last one, in order to support the South Africans bid for the Square Kilometre Array, SALT telescope, and other initiatives in Africa with the South African program. The launch is May the 12th. The Minister of Science and Technology is coming. He's one of our strongest supporters. He's an absolutely remarkable man. He did a maths degree in prison, did a master's on black holes as a refugee in Zimbabwe. He's really a wonderful guy. Minister of Education will be there. Somebody you know will be there. In fact, two people you know will be there. Head of NASA is coming. First time he's been to Africa. And Stephen Hawking is coming. We're going to have a big public lecture, which we are hoping will be webcast around the world by CERN. CERN is going to send two technicians to film it, and we hope this will be a big sort of consciousness-raising thing. I spoke to Bob Geldof. He was at TED, and he's maybe he'll come too. There are all sorts of links to local science initiatives, universities, etc. And that's all I want to say, so thanks very much. All the teaching is done by visiting lecturers. We have 3-week blocks. So we have 20 lecture blocks per year, 20, 24, something like that, lecture blocks per year. Each one is 3 weeks. And then we have 6 tutors who stay there year round. So these are people with fresh PhDs, sometimes even master's students, who live with the students, and basically they implement the continuity of the program. So when a lecturer arrives, the tutors will meet with them, say, what are you planning to lecture? Show us your notes. And usually they say, you know, throw that away. You know, because you're taking students who, even though they're very bright, have had very patchy education. And you cannot assume they know what Schrodinger's equation is or whatever. I mean, you have to start from scratch. But they are very bright and they'll catch on quickly, but you have to actually explain everything you're doing from not assuming, not making assumptions. So it's a very different way of teaching. You have 3 weeks in which you have to convey all the information, you have to assess the students as you go. It's all continuous. So you will lecture for 2 hours in the morning. In the afternoon, you'll solve problems for 2 hours on the morning's material, straight away. The tutors are working with the students and observing how each student is doing. And at the end of every week, the tutors make a big table of how each student is coping. And then that's fed back to the lecturer. And the lecturer said, you know, you're going too fast, you're going too slow, whatever it is. But it all has to be finished at the end of 3 weeks. There's no more teaching on that course. So it's a really different way of operating. And we fine-tuned this over 4.5 years, and it works extremely well.
I'm just going to ask a question that many people want to ask. How can we help you?
Well, we need some obvious things. We need money. As I said, it's about $10,000 per student. For a year, and what we're trying to do is raise an endowment that each one of these centers will need an endowment of about $10 million. What we would do, and this is how AIMS worked, we raised charitable contributions. We have about 25 donors for AIMS, small amounts. We then go to government and we say, we've got the scholarships funded, but you have to pay all the running costs if you want this institute in your country. And that's great because now the government buys in, they pay half the costs, they take ownership, the minister comes there all the time, they say, this is our center, take credit for it, they students have connections with government, industry, etc. You have to have local ownership. So that's our model. Each center needs $10 million endowment. Government then pays all the running costs. So money's the obvious thing. Okay. Less obvious, we need lecturers, but as I say, we're oversubscribed. Nevertheless, you're welcome to register on the website. There's a database. We have 400 people signed up to lecture, and so you have to make a pretty damn good application if you're going to be accepted. Okay. You really are competing with the best lecturers in the world if you want to teach here. But being so oversubscribed, we have to expand to other countries. So if you volunteer to teach at the new nodes as they open, of course there'll be less oversubscribed. The thing we're really looking for at this point is people who are willing to take a year out. Okay, take a year out of your career, go to one of these new centers. We hope to open 3 later this year. Go to one of those centers and live there for a year and support what's going on. Okay, just bring your skills, fit in as you are needed, and I just guarantee you it will be the experience of a lifetime, because you are so valued, and the skill set you have is incredibly useful. So we're looking for people willing to make that kind of commitment to support these centers. And if we had 2 or 3 Western academics full-time at each of these places, they won't do most of the lecturing by any means. They will fill in and support the program. That would be absolutely fantastic. So we're really looking for that. Yeah. Do you mean go back to their home country? They come to South Africa and you're saying... Well, that's why we're building all these centers all over Africa, to attract them back. There's no way to attract them back unless you create conditions which they can work in Africa. So we have to create those centers. That's the whole point of making centers around Africa that are good. So if you ask me what are the prospects of bringing them back, I think they're very good. All the students, all of our graduates, if you ask them, what do you want to do with your career? They all say, I want to be a scientist in Africa. It's especially interesting, the women, even more so. For the women, it's not even a question. They are part of their communities back home. For them, it's just they have to go back and teach and do research and so on at home. So I think the prospects are excellent, and we improve it by bringing students, like Shehu, you saw. So even though he's finishing his PhD, last September came back to Ames for a month to tutor in order to keep him engaged. So all the graduates of Ames, we have to bring him back regularly to help with the teaching, keep them interested, inform them of all the developments. And when these centers open, they should go back and help staff those centers. And just right now, quite a lot of people are getting their PhDs who went through the first year. And those are the people we've got to draw back. But, you know, this will happen. The thing is, we cannot slow down. You slow down, you lose them. So we have to go very, very fast. Okay, so Ted says you can make a wish. And they will try to make it come true. So the minute they told me that on the telephone, I knew exactly what the wish was. Whether it can be made to come true is another matter. But the wish is, and this wish is, you know, you have to negotiate with them. Because if they're going to make it come true, you know, they need to be realistic. So my wish is that the next Einstein will be in Africa. Yep, we're going to build him. So the way I phrased it at the conference is that the wish consists, it's not my wish, it's all of our wish, And the wish consists of two parts. There's a dream, which is that the next Einstein will be African, and there's a plan. And the plan is to build all these centers. And basically, I was quite nervous about this wish, because it's will there ever be another Einstein? Who knows? You know. But that's what we're aiming for. We're aiming for innovation, creative genius, you know, the heights of intellectual achievement. And I think you have to aim high. And a lot of the problem with conventional approaches to development is they see Africa as a problem, they look down on it, they don't encourage Africans to take initiatives and to, you know, do things for themselves. So we're changing that. We're aiming very high. And as my brother said, my brother's a businessman, and he, as he says, you know, if you shoot for the stars, you'll hit the moon. And so, you know, the reality is that 99% of students are not going to be Einstein. Well, 99.9999% of students are not going to be Einstein. What are they going to do? They're going to use their computer skills, their modeling skills, their creative skills, their problem-solving skills. I mean, right now, the head of Coca-Cola distribution in Ghana is an Ames graduate. He's using the mathematical modeling he learned at Ames to model Coca-Cola distribution in Ghana. Okay? He's very successful. And that's what's going to happen. And so, as I said, I was a bit nervous about this dream because it sounds so ambitious. And what I was so delighted about is the response. There was essentially only one person who argued with me about this dream. Everyone else said, of course that's what we need. We need another Einstein, and of course they should be African. But one person argued with me, and that was, funnily enough, that was Bob Geldof. So we had a ding-dong argument, and he's basically pushing charity, he's pushing investment in restaurants and, you know, businesses which will create wealth, which of course are wonderful things. So I went away for 20 minutes and left him alone and came back and said, look, Bob, are you going to help us with this program? He said, of course I'm going to help you. This is so important. So he came round too. So I think it will work. I mean, whether we'll get another Einstein, who knows? But we're going to get some very brilliant people. I mean, I can tell you the top one or two in the class at Ames are off scale, way off scale. I teach electromagnetism and relativity, just as a sort of physics course that shows how powerful maths can be. So they have that picture that one equation can describe this massive array of phenomena. There's no better subject than electromagnetism. So I teach that. And I had a student from Madagascar who'd done computer science. They started off with Coulomb's law, electrostatics, how you calculate electric fields, plane sheets. And there are some subtleties. I mean, you can get infinities if you think about things the wrong way, very easily. After 3 days, this guy had better arguments than I had for how to calculate electric fields. I mean, he's just very, very smart kid. And I think we're going to surprise. The world is going to be surprised by what these students can do. Sure. Yeah, so let me talk about Sudan. We had students right from the beginning from Sudan, and it was the only country where the university paid their travel to Ames. We asked them. We said, please do everything you can to find your travel. Next thing we know, the Faculty of Science in Sudan paid for the students' travel. Big sacrifice for them. So we went to Sudan to visit, and of course you're nervous because of Darfur, and they have this horrendous government, etc., etc. But we do not get the full picture about Sudan in the West. Sudan is booming. The center of Khartoum is a kilometer square that is like Malaysia. They have 40 skyscrapers going up. This is going to be a massive business center. They have oil. The Chinese have built a big pipeline. The economy is booming. It's a safe town. Walk around day and night. It's safe. So all kinds of things about it which you don't expect. But we said to them, you are unfundable from the West because of Darfur. Let's try to figure out, you know, how we can overcome this. And they are mathematicians and scientists, and they're pragmatic. And they said, well, what should we do? So we came up with a plan that the proposal from Sudan has to be joint. Khartoum and Juba. Juba is the south Christian area. Historically, there's been tension. So it's a joint proposal with Juba and with the university in Darfur called Al-Fashir. And this proposal was now joint between these three universities. And so basically, we're trying to use maths and science as a means of overcoming these tensions. I mean, of course, it doesn't overcome the tensions, but it helps communication, it's an example, etc., etc. So we are trying to get it funded. It's almost certainly unfundable from Western sources, but I'm going to Dubai next month, and interestingly, Khartoum is called the Cambridge of the Arab world, because it's the oldest university in the Arab world. Many of the academics in Arab countries were trained in Khartoum. There's a long tradition, reputation, etc. So we're going to try, even though it's difficult, and we have to be very careful of the politics, not to give the government any credit for it. It's a vicious government, but you know, you have to make this decision. Do you just walk away, as Steven Spielberg did, or do you engage? And it's a tough decision to make, but we want to engage with them. You get the are very high. Mm-hmm. Non-existent. That's correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Every student in my course makes an electric motor. So I totally agree, but this is a big, as you say, tabletop experiments are actually rather easy. You don't want precise numbers. I mean, I think one of the failures, you see, this is not a problem just in Africa, this is everywhere. People do this theoretical thing, and they do these experiments for a physics degree where you plug the numbers into a computer and it analyzes all the data, and you actually lose touch with what's really going on. So I think all the diseases in academia we have in the West are there in Africa times a thousand. We need experiments, and you can do it with tin cans and string and sellotape, and we try to do that. And it's tough, because students are used to thinking of themselves as academics. They're kind of above the world. The way we use computers is almost as a lab, because every course has a computer project. And so we encourage people to play with equations, in that way. It almost takes the role of a lab. But this tabletop experiments and just using ordinary junk to do experiments is really needed.
Neil has to give another talk.
Okay.